Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 211. The year is 1857, heading into 1858. Lots to talk about. The original frontier republics and wildlands were being transformed, turning into governed territories. In 1856, Natal was created a crown colony by royal charter. Legislation there was entrusted to a council of four officials and 12 members elected every 4 years by ballot. By the way, this was not only a first for South Africa, but for Great Britain itself, an experiment in election power, although the Crown retained considerable powers of veto. A civil list of those who could vote was more than modest, although the low franchise meant most were eligible to vote. Most English and Dutch, that is, not blacks. What really angered the elected members was that £5,000 for administration was earmarked by the Crown for the benefit of black Natalians. Still, the new and unique Natal Legislative Council sat for the first time in March 1857, and its first job was to authorise a new Crown Colony stamp. Yes, you heard right, a stamp. Only a recent invention, the world's first postage stamp, launched in 1840, was the penny black, bearing a portrait of Queen Victoria. Up until then, the heavily subsidized British post office had a clumsy system of expensive charges based on distance and the number of pages in a letter. It relied on payments by recipients who were often unable or even unwilling to pay. Sending an ordinary letter from London to Edinburgh cost more than 10 shillings, 10 bob in old speak. Rowland Hill, an English reformer, published a pamphlet which made the case for the postage stamp and for sweeping postal reforms. Hill argued for a low uniform rate based on weight, a penny for half an ounce, for delivery anywhere in the country, and for payment as evidenced by an affixed stamp before it was sent. Thus, our friends in Natal, sitting in the first ever legislative council, launched their stamp. Modern innovations in Durban. Who knew? The stamp was a powerful statement of communication in a world dominated by the British Empire. Now, a mother at home in England could send a letter to her son at some regiment based in the depths of India. Letters between England and India followed a curious route. Earlier, all trade had cycled past Cape Town, but by 1857, letters would be carried by steamship from London to Malta, from there to Alexandria in Egypt, overland to Suez, and from there on board another steamship to Bombay. The bypassed Cape Town acquired its own regular postal service in 1857. It took Australia a lot longer. They only began postal service in 1870, with New Zealand a distant last in the Empire's lists of ports. Their posts came via San Francisco by way of the American Transcontinental Railroad and Transatlantic Steamer. The rest of the world caught up quickly with this new stamp invention thing. And would you believe it, but the first country apart from Great Britain to launch stamps were the Brazilians in 1843. The Swiss canton of Zurich followed, then America in 1845. Mauritius was right up there, the next to launch, followed by Bermuda. During the 1850s, stamps spread through most of the European countries, and by 1857, many regions of the world were connected in one way or another through the remarkable little piece of coloured and embossed paper glued to an envelope. So you can understand the Natal legislature's urgent need to plug into their empire. Let's stand back for a moment. 20 years before this, in the late 1830s, there had been only one Western-style government in South Africa, the Cape. By 1857, there were 8, 3 colonial and 5 republican. That is, the Cape Colony, British Kaferia and Natal on one hand, and on the other, the Orange Free State, Utrecht Republic, Lydenburg, the Zoutpansberg, and Pretorius's South African Republic. This was balkanization. Little entrepôts, squabbling states spread out across the Southern African landscape, sometimes working together, more often than not competing. Natal was a kind of detached district of the Cape until it was declared a crown colony, rather an inconvenient way to run a territory. In Natal, most of the Boers had gone, except for the northern parts. In their place came the Europeans, like the Germans. A few had taken to market gardening around Durban, while Joseph Byrne and other speculators had launched various schemes for British immigrants. As you know by now, if you've listened to the series, quite a few of the new arrivals left almost immediately. Living in Natal is not for the squeamish, even today. Still, the villages of Pantan, Verulam, and Richmond owe their existence to these English immigrants, and so too those of Ladysmith. By 1857, there were only 8,000 whites in Natal, 150,000 blacks, and what they all lacked in size, they made up by being vigorous. A plethora of religious sects existed, each with their own education system. Associations sprang up, and the Natal Bank opened its doors. Soon there were 6 newspapers in Natal, including The Witness in Pietermaritzburg and The Mercury in Durban. However, there was almost zero industry, and both coffee and cotton had failed. The first sugarcane was imported from Mauritius and seemed to offer more. The problem was labor. But for many years hence, the main export from Natal was ivory. And as we know, elephants were being shot out of existence at breakneck speed. This was not a sustainable industry. Imports exceeded exports, but the trade deficit in Natal was papered over by what was known as a native hut tax. There is a propensity by some to say that the hut tax was created with one main aim, to drive blacks to labor for whites. Historically, however, the main motivation was money, cash. It appeared that the primary motive for African taxation was simply to raise revenue and produce labor for the agriculture, and then the mining industry came second. But in 1857, there was no mining industry to speak of. The native hut tax was purely fiscal at first. The British government had made it clear to numerous governors that they should try to balance the books, make the colonials pay the costs, and by inference, the black people living in the territories. The meager size of the white population meant directly taxing them, a kind of personal tax, would backfire and they'd leave. So authorities turned their beady eyes on black Natalians. The settlers complained that while they had to pay for the land they were on, blacks could merely take up a stand where they liked in the rest of the territory, under command of the chiefs. As you know, the chiefs had control of the land, but the point was no money changed hands. But how do you go about collecting hut taxes across Natal? This was a logistical problem until diplomatic agent Theophilus Shepstone figured out that the reserves could be further demarcated, separating white and black land, so to speak. And then in 1849, the hut tax was introduced. An amount of 7 shillings would be levied on every hut inhabited by a black Natalian, and levied specifically on black men. Each adult male had to pay a fee, and the local magistrate and the chief were both tasked with collecting this cash. In direct rule, the chief collecting money on behalf of the empire, a tax on his or sometimes her own people. If the man did not labor for cash, he could pay the tax in cattle or other goods. This is where the sugar arriving from Mauritius gets interesting. Quite swiftly, farmers realized that the hut tax and perhaps other forms of taxation could be introduced to force blacks off the reserves and onto the farms as labor. So the initial launch of the tax was fiscal, but rapidly thereafter it became useful as an instrument to ensure labor was secured. By 1870, Africans contributed 75% of all the revenue collected by the Natal government. If we glance at Southern Africa as a whole in 1857, we would notice that government had become more elaborate and less subordinated to the Cape. Local justice was now in the hands of local magistrates. Lieutenant governors changed with bewildering rapidity, but their powers were growing as these little states began to emerge, blinking like undersized infants into the African sunshine. Federation instead of balkanization was in the air, at least in the mind of Cape Governor Sir George Grey. The Boers, of course, were not thinking of anything of the sort, let alone federation. After the wars, the settlers in the Cape were dead set against the reserves, the Theophilus Shepstone plan. These, they said, drained off labour. And, said the nervous English immigrants, it was dangerous to mass blacks in the heart of any colony. The effect of the Battle of Ndunda Kusuka didn't help Shepstone. Thousands of AmaZulu refugees of the Civil War across the Tugela River flooded into Natal, leading to Natal's immigrant rules. Further inland, the policy of the republics was even more blunt. Ironically, Piet Retief, the man killed by Dingane, had promised there shall be no slavery and repeatedly warned his men against seizing children of unwilling San and Khoi as what they were cunningly called apprentices. Despite his reservations about the system, he was a man of his time and believed proper relations between master and servant should be properly enforced. Tensions were raised when missionaries like Robert Moffat and Kuruman and David Livingston helped traders, hunters, and men of the cloth travel north via their mission stations. The Boer tolerance of other churches was limited, to say the least. The Rustenburg General Assembly decreed in 1857 that none but the Dutch Reformed churches should be allowed. Their grondwet, or constitution, discouraged all churches which did not hold by what was known as the Heidelberg Catechism, and specifically they disliked Roman Catholics. On the ground, in reality, as usual, the laws were not followed. The Michalisburgers, for example, welcomed the Moravians and the Hanoverians, while at times and up to the early 1850s, the Mariekeburgers had had a fairly good relationship with the London Missionary Society, regarded as black-supporting bugbears of the 19th century. The Boers liked the fact that the gospel was being preached to people they regarded as heathen, and some would have been happier if only the missionaries would have consented to teach that the Boers were a superior race. This talk of equality before God was a social conundrum. By the end of the fifth decade, confusion reigned. The Sand River Convention had defined no boundaries other than the Vaal River, and David Livingston of the London Missionary Society was living at Kolobeng amongst the Bakwena people of Chief Sicheli. He was a particular foe of the Transvaal Boers. So they breathed a sigh of relief when Livingston took off on an expedition to the middle Zambezi River, and he came across the remarkable Lake Ngami. Then over the next few years, while troubles simmered along the upper waters of the Mariko and Molopo rivers, where his mission station was based, Livingston journeyed on into what was thought of as darkest Africa, all the way to Luanda in Angola, down the Zambezi River, past the Victoria Falls to Quelimane on the Indian Ocean. His exploits read by excited Londoners in various gazettes and brochures and newspapers. Meanwhile, both the Soutpansberg and Potchefstroom Volksraads signed peace treaties with the Amandebele, or the Matabele as they were called. This was to safeguard ivory trade and the traffic. Remember, back in 1836, the Amandebele and the Boers had fought a bloody struggle, and here they were signing peace treaties. Both Boer Volksraads also laid down general rules for the whole Transvaal, forbidding the sale of weapons to blacks under pain of death. They even passed a law banning trade between Boers and Africans, and like the British bans on trade in the Eastern Cape, real trade continues nevertheless. It's called market forces can't stop them, you know. Their missionary zeal and devotion made up for a defective education and a real knowledge of people and their affairs. Some missionaries were very impatient for social justice. Most took hearsay as truth and paradoxically tried to lead the Africans around where they lived in their mission stations instead of leaving the leading up to the chiefs. All of them felt that they were isolated guardians of a liberal tradition which was not valued by most of their white neighbours. So they spoke out, and the more they spoke out, the more alienated the Boers and the white neighbours felt. Surely these missionaries were also teaching their flocks doctrines subversive of the Boer patriarchal system. Worse, the Boers believed the missionaries were arming the black nations. It didn't help when Livingston was accused of facilitating this trade through his mission station, where traders with gunpowder did in fact cross into the north carrying their valuable cargo. The Transvaalers claimed control over the western line, which included this missionary's territory, a line that extended from the Orange River up to Mariko, along which the Bechuana people lived. The missionaries combined trade with their mission activity. This was the only way to support the stations dotted along these routes, and often that trade crossed with what both the Boers and the British authority believed was legal tender. So when David Livingston set off on his grand tour, the Boers kept a sharp eye on the western line. By the end of 1857, missionary reports had reached the ears of Sir George Grey, the Cape governor, about slavery being conducted across the Transvaal. Hushed reports circulated. The Boers denied they were using slave labour. Traffic in indentured labourers and apprentices continued, but they argued this was not slavery. Apprentices were traced from Leidenbach through Vinbach to the northeastern Cape Colony, and this was confirmed by a Free State Commission set up to probe the allegations. The farmers did not think of this as slavery. The people who were being bought and sold definitely did. What was called a nest of Boer blackbirders were living in Utrecht in northern Natal, trading children from the Swazis and selling them to local farmers or beyond. This shocked the Free State Commission so much that the Volksraad shut down the commission instead of acting on the information. These were wild lands during wild times. They knew that attempts at stopping this sort of trade would lead to a backlash amongst the headstrong Boers. Blackbirding gets its name from the coercion or kidnapping of people to work as poorly paid labourers in distant territories far from their native lands. The name first circulated in the 19th century when South Sea Islanders or Kanakas were dragged from places like Papua New Guinea, the Solomon Islands, Vanuatu and so on and shipped to white colonies in New South Wales, Queensland, Samoa, New Zealand, Fiji, Hawaii and New Caledonia, amongst other places. The Blackbirders was the name given to the ship's owners, crew and captains. These ships began operating in the 1840s and, believe it or not, continued until the 1930s. These days, something called blackbirding and indentured labourers are those dragged from Southeast Asia to the Middle East to work as virtual slaves in building sports stadiums. Piet Retief was against this policy. He knew that the British authorities would use this as an excuse to interfere in Boer Republic affairs. Even Hendrik Potgieter, the old man of the Boer struggle, had reported to the Natal Volksraad a bad case of blackbirding beyond the Vaal River on the eve of the second occupation of Port Natal by the British. Hermanus Potgieter, who we met in the episode that dealt with the siege of the Makapansgat caves, was a blackbirder himself. Martinus Pretorius was another who was fingered by Free State President Boshoff in 1857, accused of dealing in apprentices contrary to the spirit of the Sand River Convention. Boshoff wanted Sir George Grey to cut off powder supplies to Potchefstroom. As you are aware by now, the Boer republics did not always get along. They hardly ever got along. Many of the allegations and counter-allegations were disingenuous. Grey appeared to discount most of these bits of information about the trade of people. Still, he was trying to avoid getting involved in any new adventures north of the Orange River. It took him a year's hard work to stop Theophilus Shepstone's plan for a great trek into no man's land near the Drakensberg, leading 50,000 AmaZulu to the new Garden of Eden. Grey's logic was that 50,000 more AmaZulu would trek into Natal from Zululand just to replace them. By now, the Crimean War had ended, but the Indian mutiny had started. The troops, which were going to be made available to pacify South Africa, ended up heading around the Cape of Good Hope and onwards to India. The Boers, and the Basutu in particular, took note, and trouble started almost immediately. Still afflicted by their border problems, Free State President Boshoff had to confront Martinus Pretorius, who wanted to unite the two Boer republics, the Free State and Potchefstroom. Driven by a misconception that the majority of the Free Staters desired amalgamation with their northern brethren, and claiming to have inherited the leadership of the Free State from his father, Pretorius entered Bloemfontein on the 22nd of February 1857, and on the next day declared his intention to take over the state and outlawed the Boshoff government. Rejecting his claims, the Boshoff government deported him and charged his supporters with sedition. This provoked the mobilization of commanders on both sides of the Vaal River, who confronted each other on the opposite banks of the Ronostra Rivier on the 25th of May, 1857. Remarkably, Pretorius had somehow got his hand on 6 field guns, ready to blast his fellow Boers. But Pretorius had banked on many Marskappers deserting Boshoff and joining his army, and was thus dismayed, and nay, surprised. Not only were there not many people defecting to his side, but he now also had a further and more dangerous enemy in his rear. Enemies in the rear are a real pain. Stephanus Schoeman, the Soutpansberg commandant, with whom he competed for the leadership of the Transvaal, had formed an alliance with the Free State. Scared he would be annihilated, Potch Republic President Martinus Pretorius agreed to sign an agreement by which both republics acknowledged each other's autonomy on the 1st of June 1857. This abortive civil war, however, exposed only too clearly the deep divisions among the Boers. The agreement did not remove the tension among the three factions which had emerged in the Orange Free State, consisting of the Loyalists, who were for re-annexation to the Cape Colony and the British, the supporters of Boshoff, who stood for Orange Free State independence, and the Unionists, who wanted to incorporate into the Transvaal. The tensions reached such a pitch that Boshoff was forced into a tactical resignation in February 1858 And when he withdrew his resignation, several members of the Volksraad left in protest. And there were increasing border quarrels with King Moshoeshoe to worry about. They were heading towards a war, which I'll describe in full next episode. While all these tribulations were sweeping across the South African landscape, globally it appeared some conditions were improving. The Industrial Revolution was going hammer and tongs. Gold had been discovered in California and speculators were salivating, and a lack of manufacturing in the colonies all gave easy money and credit to the English. Banking in South Africa accelerated. In 1856, there were 17 in the Cape, 2 in the Free State, 1 in Natal. There were still no banks in the Transvaal. Neither the Potchefstroom nor the Soutpansberg republics had any sort of financial institution. As we'll see, by 1862, a scant 6 years from this moment, there would be 28 banks in the Cape. And what's more, 2 imperial banks had installed themselves in their comfy chairs in Cape Town, including Standard Bank. Trade was flourishing in the Cape Colony. Cattle and horse sickness, smallpox, drought, and the terrible fungal infection that destroyed grapevines, odium, had all been checked. Sulphur was now being sprayed on Cape vineyards, killing the fungus. Horse sickness had drained away along with smallpox. The drought had broken. Copper from the Cape and wool exports from what was called the Liverpool of the Cape, Port Elizabeth, were breaking records. Grey had also managed to increase immigration from Europe, and the white and black populations were both increasing in leaps and bounds. Lighthouses were being built, and a breakwater was being planned for Table Bay, the waters of which were notoriously dangerous during storms. The South African Public Library was being constructed, and railway and telegraph links were under consideration. Lurking further east, however, was a growing jealousy between Port Elizabeth, Port Francis, Grahamstown, and Graaf Reinet. All wanted to dominate this wonderful wool trade, and their jostling for a railway line meant they'd actually get none at all, at least initially. With that, it's time to blow out the lantern for this episode. Please rate the episode on your favorite platforms. That helps elevate its visibility, and you can head off to desmondlatham.blog. You can email me from there too. Until next, tot ziens.